Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. I work from a home office, and I really like it. That's not been the case for my whole career. And sometimes I do miss the camaraderie and the interaction of being in a workplace and kind of colleagues who are right there, you know, with you, of course. A water cooler conversation in my office is a lot like talking to yourself at a stoplight, right? But one of the many privileges of working from home is that if you feel like you need a change of space, even if you have sort of a designated space, which I do in our home, you can still often move to a different room. And so one morning when I was working on this talky bit, I chose to work downstairs at a table in the kitchen. And I know you haven't all been in our home, but some of you might be able to picture this. So this is the table that's sort of not in the busy hub of the kitchen, but sort of right next to it. And the house was quiet, dog was asleep, Crean was away, all very peaceful. I'm not saying it's not peaceful when Crean's home. That's not my point. But the table that I was working at gave me a view of the back of our yard, which is bordered by a wide band of native prairie grasses. And so when you look out that window, that's what you're looking at. It's just this wall of prairie grass. And these things get really tall. Like in the summer, they're well over 6 feet tall. They're a hedge of grass. And when they die off in the fall, they turn this gorgeous reddish-brown color. I don't even know if we have a color name for that color. But it's incredibly beautiful. And they also self-seed grasses. And so when they mature, they drop their seeds onto the ground. And the birds, as you can probably imagine, love them. They just love them. I mean, from a bird's vantage point, I can't get inside a bird's head, but the things I see are that these grasses provide shelter, and they provide food, and they provide nesting places at their bases, and they provide perches to sit on. They provide a lot of things for the birds. Now, the perches to sit on piece is a little bit complicated, especially after the grasses are dead. So at this time of the year, some of those grasses are still standing. Some have collapsed as part of their just natural dying off, but a number of them are still standing, but they don't have the same robustness that they have when they're in season. And some of them have already collapsed, but all of them are much more brittle and much more fragile. So when the birds try to land on them at this time of the year, the results are mixed. And it's highly entertaining to watch, but in my imagination at least, it's a bit disconcerting if you're a bird. Because they fly in, and you can kind of watch them, right? They fly in, and they spread their wings, and they extend their feet for a landing, and then they touch down on the stem of the grass, and then, like, anything could happen, right? So sometimes the grass holds up, and they sort of happily sit there on a relatively stable perch. Sometimes the grass bends, and they sort of track along with it, but they still get a perch. And sometimes they kind of stay there until they're like done with whatever they were doing hanging around, and then they go down to the ground to look for seeds. And sometimes the grass just folds up underneath them and they have to perform this sort of abrupt self-rescue maneuver, right, with not a lot of clearance before the ground. My experience is that there's value in simply sitting and taking something like that in. There doesn't have to be a lesson. But for me, on this particular morning, it felt like there was. I found myself thinking about what it feels like to re-examine or reconsider something that I once found both beautiful and stable and predictable. And what had me thinking about that, in part, at least no surprise here, I expect, was the Christian mythology surrounding Easter. And just in case you're not familiar with my take on it, by mythology, I mean meaning-making story or guiding story, those kinds of ideas. And I'm not going to unpack that any further in our context today, but I wanted to mention it in case it's sort of helpful to have the term itself clarified. That Christian Easter story, to summarize it, to really broad brush summarize it, is the one in which the Jewish rabbi Jesus of Nazareth is tortured to death by the Romans. He's put into a donated tomb and then discovered 3 days later to no longer be there, and subsequently seen by several people before somehow being taken up into the sky and disappearing for good. When you think about it, being taken up into the sky probably isn't even that noteworthy as an encore if your main act was coming back from the dead. But it does make quite a story, right? It really does. And it's proven to be an enduring narrative, one that, you know, I think most people who examine these things would say is really the pivot of the Christian story and an even bigger deal than Christmas, even though the retailers have gotten a lot more traction with Santa than with Caesar as a power-wielding central figure. But let me bring this back to birds and precarious landings. So for many years, that traditional story operated in my imagination as a quite literal one, without any great amount of cognitive dissonance. The fact that rising from the dead is not, you know, to put it mildly, normal, wasn't distressing, because I was always taught that that is something you accepted by faith. And even if it wasn't especially approachable by reason, faith would take care of that. It was like, in my bird metaphor, it was like a good sturdy branch of prairie grass at the height of summer. It was like a safe place to land and to hang out. It was beautiful, it was alive, it was sustaining. But for me at least, the seasons changed and the story changed along with them. It's still there, but it doesn't look like it once did. There's still beauty in it, and the seeds it's planted in my life continue to offer some fruitful possibilities, but it's changed. It's no longer what it once was. So for me at least, and I suspect because I get to have these conversations with lots of people, that metaphorical experience of coming in for a landing and finding that the landing pad isn't what it was has required some adjustment. That's probably a little bit too static a way to say it. That was past tense. It should be present tense. It's more like watching the birds bobbing and weaving in the spring breezes. It requires some adjustment. So with that image in mind, what I wanted to do today was share some things that I find helpful when it comes to reconsidering the once familiar and making it mine in a new way, in a new setting, in a changing context, however we might want to think about that. And I'm going to frame these things as questions, and I'm going to come at this as an exercise in considering new directions, in not getting stuck where I was, if that makes sense. And to give credit where it's due, the inspiration for these particular questions and their shape comes from some reflections by David Duchemin, a photographer friend of mine whose way of thinking I find consistently challenging and inspiring. So the first question is, how can I change my point of view? And that doesn't need to mean that the point of view I'm familiar with is or even has been one I need to be negative or dismissive about. Seeing things the same way I always have, regarding them from the point of view I typically do, can simply cease to be satisfying. If I think about this more in the realm in which David was reflecting when he wrote that question, if I think about this as a person actually taking pictures, this is like the shift from just standing there, normally upright, pointing my phone at something at eye level. And that's my point of view. To literally changing my POV, to literally changing my point of view. David likes to tell a story about finally giving in a couple of years ago and buying chest waders so he could get his camera closer to water level. David's a world photographer and also a wildlife photographer, and he spends a bunch of time every year in Alaska photographing grizzly bears. And to see some of David's grizzlies from water level, yeah, it's visceral is what it is. And among the photographs that this change has produced from David is a startlingly evocative image of a man swimming with a wild-eyed horse. He's in the surf, he's in the ocean, it's in India somewhere. And it's one of those pictures that when you look at it, you feel like you're in the water with both of these living beings, and you're not sure you A, should be, or B, want to be there. There's a lot of energy in the photograph, and a lot of it's about fear.
So let me move that over to the realm of beliefs or ideas and phrase the question this way. When was the last time that you were close enough to an idea or belief that felt dangerous to you that you could, so to speak, see the whites of its eyes? You could see its nostrils flare. You had the feeling that if it thrashed it the wrong way, it would send you flying. It would upset you or injure you. Maybe that was reading a book from an author whose worldview was really unfamiliar. Maybe it's a podcast, an interview, a conversation. Maybe it's really digging into some art expression that isn't the usual go-to. Maybe it's having a genuinely curious conversation with someone we know we disagree with. You could wonder, why would anyone do that? And it sounds uncomfortable at best and perhaps truly hazardous, both the literal expression of it and the metaphoric one. And I would say to both of those possibilities, discomfort and danger, I would say, well, yes. It might be both of those, and it might be many things in between. There might be as many reasons to avoid doing something like that as there are to do it. And honestly, personally, and I think there's also, you know, there's brain science and evolutionary, biological, and all kinds of reasons for this, but finding the reasons not to do it comes way easier than the other side. But on the plus side, on the doing it side, is that when our previous normal stops working in some way, changing our point of view can help us get unstuck. And far too often, I think the alternative is that we kind of keep on churning around in some version of what we know and have known, what's been handed to us, and we kind of keep recycling ideas with these little modifications, these little tweaks, just to keep from having to face the significant discomfort of change. In other words, we don't really change our point of view, and as a result, we stay stuck. So that's question number one. How can I change my point of view? Question number two is there a habit I need to change? All right. So this one can be a bruiser because habits bring us a lot of comfort. And that's true even when they're bad or unhelpful habits. The routine itself is a comfort. And it's one we can partake in even while we're simultaneously thinking, this is a bad idea, right? I mean, you know, as my brother once said, one of my siblings once said, about a feeling that they were dealing with, when I'm having this feeling, what I really want to do is just fall into a beanbag chair and put my hand elbow deep into a bag of Miss Vicky's until it's all gone, even though I know that's not the thing I most need to do. But that's what I feel like doing, right? Learning something new is risky because it means, among other things, that we are going to feel uncomfortable, clumsy. We're probably going to do some things that feel like failure to us. And in fact, the rate at which we're going to experience those kinds of things is likely to go up compared to if we do the thing we already know. And really, how many of us like that feeling? And if you'll indulge me, I'm going to make it worse for a moment before I make any attempt at making it better. This all applies not only to habits of behavior, but also habits of thought and habits of belief. What's the difference, do you think, between a groove and a rut? I know it might sound like the opening line to a joke, but in this case, I'm attempting to poke at something kind of serious. Staying stuck in a belief that isn't integral for us is not the path to vital, vigorous belief. It's more likely to produce cynicism than it is to foster anything for which we would use a word like faith. Which does actually bring, if not a joke, then at least a folksy saying to mind. A rut is just a grave with the ends kicked out. I trust that we can appreciate the irony of discovering that beliefs we hold that claim to be about life or life abundant or some of those ideas can actually be paths to something quite different from that if we continue to practice them or engage with them after we already sense that they are no longer life-giving for us. Now, none of this kind of exploration, I would say, is something we should do because someone else said we should. This is a journey to set out on because we aren't satisfied with where we're at, because something about our existing approach is leaving us feeling unfulfilled, disengaged. Also, What happens, and this can sound kind of bumper stickery, but stay with me, what happens to how we think about this if we stop thinking about failure rate when we're trying something new and we start thinking about learning rate? Because we can't learn something new without disrupting or displacing something familiar. And that might be an ouch, but I think it's an unavoidable ouch if we want to grow and change. Author Susan David, book I think is called Emotional Agility, says that, I don't know if this is from the book or from something I just heard her say, but she says that discomfort is the price of admission for a meaningful life. And I might not feel warm and fuzzy about that idea. No, I don't feel warm and fuzzy about that idea. But I think there is something undeniably true about it. And I want to have a meaningful life. One in which I hold beliefs that are, to use my oft-quoted Bono song lyric, songs that I can sing in my own company. That's question two for me. Is there a habit I need to change, including a habit of belief? Question number three, do I need to change the story I'm telling myself? I did say the last one was a bruiser, right? I should have saved that description for this one. As humans, I don't think we just like to tell stories to explain things. We do like to tell stories to explain things. But I think we, beyond that, we think of ourselves, we think of our existence, of who we are as a story. We live inside of stories. And that can be lovely and helpful, of course. But it can also be a place where we get stuck and we're changing the story, or even a detail in the story can have quite an impact. Simple example, at least this is simple to articulate, might not be simple to do, but might be represented by something like this. It might be represented by making a shift from seeing the world as out to get me to seeing the world as sometimes hard for and hard on everyone, including me. The theme that the world can be a tough place remains intact in both those stories, but in the second one, I'm not a lonely victim in it. I'm a fellow traveler with other people who are also facing challenges, and that means, among other things, that I probably have something to offer them, and they may well have some empathy and care to offer me if I let them know I'm struggling. They might kind of get it. And that's not a little shift. And let me just add, and I think this is more for the benefit of people who might, you know, pop in and hear something like this in the context of a podcast, and less so for those of us who are part of the conversation in an ongoing way, but let me just add that beliefs about God are fair game in this. Those ideas, as soon as we start to study their history, reveal themselves to be, among other things, changeable. They all came from somewhere, they've morphed sometimes a great deal over time, and they can, I would say they must, continue to change, or they become dusty artifacts of history. If you want a very accessible, you know, takes less than 5 minutes of your life, relatively benign experience of this, potentially, at least, just Google search, where did the idea of original sin come from? And just read the first two paragraphs of the Wikipedia page. It doesn't take very long. Now, don't do this if you don't want to find yourself asking a question like, is the whole notion that Jesus had to die to save us from the wrath of God one I don't want to disrupt? Like, if you don't want to give that a kick, don't do what I just suggested. Because that idea, Jesus had to die to save us from the wrath of God, stands on a whole string of other human stories that are attempting to explain how we as a species are capable of behaving in ways that harm one another, which I think is one of the great, and I would say unsolved, perennial human questions. So beautiful, so terrible. How can this be? All in one container. Is that too on the nose for Easter Sunday? Just in case it is, let's stand back a little bit, move it to a metaphor for a moment. In this case, a photographic one. David, applying similar lines of thinking to helping people get unstuck as photographers, puts it this way. Quote, the impulse to get the safe shot overtaking the risky shot is the same impulse that keeps you in your rut. You've got enough safe shots. Safe shots don't teach you, and they don't satisfy. Feel free to disagree. But it's an interesting perspective, isn't it, on getting unstuck. There are other places that we could take this, but I'm going to more or less leave it there for now. One final qualifier. I don't think a talky bit like this is necessarily meant for everyone. I think it's for people that aren't satisfied with the beliefs they've been handed or that they have held without examining them. I think this is for folks who might be feeling like they've got enough safe shots and it's time to take a risk. I think that's who some of these ideas are for, and that's not everyone. Having said that, as a community, that's what we're here for. And we don't call it around here taking a risky shot. Today we talked about it in terms of feeling like the places that used to feel like solid landing spots don't feel that way anymore. And every time we gather, we call it exploring what you believe. It's why we're here. Even on, maybe especially on, Easter Sunday. Peace.